Ms. Morabit, thank you so much for coming to IPI. We're really pleased to have you here. I want to start the interview by focusing on the most recent events that have taken place in Libya in these past few weeks. What do you think led up to the death of the United States envoy to Libya, Christopher Stevens? What's the background to that?
First, I'd like to say thank you for having me. It's been an honor and a pleasure to be here and to meet so many other amazing people at the panel this morning. In regards to your first question, it's a very loaded question, of course. Ambassador Stevens was actually quite a close friend to our organization and somebody who I had the privilege of knowing and who only a week before we had ran into him actually at the airport, and he had one bodyguard. He was not somebody who took people en masse with him. He was not somebody with a crazy security protocol. He was somebody who very much believed in Libya and believed in the democracy and in the transition. And so his death comes, I think, very much as a shock to anybody who knew him. He was somebody who at times actually told us that we needed to stay and fight harder. And I truly don't think that there was a logical lead up to his death. I don't think it was an occurrence that anybody expected. And I don't think it's something that I can even actually wrap my head around now, which weeks later. It's not something that I ever would have anticipated. And I honestly cannot give you a point-blank reason for his passing. I do think that the excuses used, one of them being the anti-Islamic film, are just that. And that's a very personal opinion, of course. But I don't think that it was based on a film per se.
What do those events reflect about the current situation in Libya and the challenges in the country?
I think that if we're going to look at those events, we have to look at the events following them. It's very difficult for us to say, okay, well, there's one occasion happened, a very tragic occasion, and that's the only thing we're going to look at. I think we instead need to look at what happened after. What was the response from the Libyan people? And immediately, within hours of people finding out that it was Ambassador Chris Stevens, and even before when they found out there was an attack, there was outrage. But upon finding out it was him, immediately you had Facebook pages going up of, you know, I'm Libyan and I am against this. You had I'm Sorry Project. You had Libyans going out by the hundreds protesting against this and vigils. And following that, you had a march of 30 to 40,000 people in Benghazi called the Save Benghazi protest. And I think that if we look at what's happened after, it's more important even than what's happened prior to in this revolution. And it shows a true response from the Libyan people that, no, we don't stand for extremism. We don't stand for actions taken against certain individuals or certain entities, be it embassies or organizations, et cetera. And instead, we stand for a society in which the people are in control. The government has mechanisms and an apparatus which ensure the security of all, regardless of whether they're Libyan or not, or whether they're a minority or majority, and that needs to be handled immediately by the government, because up until now it was not something that they had shown they were making a priority. And you can see now, following that march, following this occurrence, the government taking a very concrete step in disbanding militias, in ensuring security for all. And I think the steps after are much more important than anything that has happened prior to.
Do you think that this is a turning point in the transition?
Yes, I do. I do. I was somebody who, if you spoke to me 3 weeks ago, I was, I'd like to call it realistic, but I was extremely pessimistic, very worried, particularly about the influence of the militias, the growing influence at that time. And particularly about not only inconsistency, but the lack of reaction from the government, from our elected individuals, from all bodies, I think, all decision-making bodies, whether they be political in terms of our government, but also economic, the Businessman's Council, which acted like nothing was happening. I was shocked, but I'm very disappointed in telling my dad, like, I think I'm done, I'm taking a break. I felt like a very exhausted citizen. No responses, nothing happening. And then this was very much a turning point. This was, for the first time in months, I felt like Libyans woke up. I felt like they realized the gravity of the situation, which is, I think, something nobody wanted to talk about. And by realizing the gravity of the situation, they took action. And they sent a message to the government that, no, we're not all asleep. Some of us, yes, still are. But we're not all asleep, and we demand action, and we demand it now. And I think the government then realized that, okay, we're in serious hot water. The same way that they rose up previously, they will do it again. And that was the message, I think, that was sent very loud and clear. And I do think it was a much needed wake-up call to the Libyan people and, more importantly, to our government, to our elected individuals.
I mean, I think that probably it's frustrating also for Libyans to be there, such a focus on one person and sort of the death of one individual or four, however many actually died in that event. And considering the amount of people that die probably on a daily basis in Libya as a result of the chaos in the country. And I can imagine that there is frustration because of that and all the other problems that are there. What are the major problems that you identify other than the issues surrounding those events we just spoke about? And also, what are the challenges that you personally are trying to address?
I have to strongly agree with you on that. I think the first thing I said following the passing of Ambassador Stevens was, and he is a close friend, and a lot of people saw it as being insincere, but I said, listen, we have been 4 months talking to our government and telling the international community that we have a problem on our hands, and nobody has reacted. And a lot of people told me, you shouldn't say that. That's not, you know, that's not fair. And I said, but it's true. Until we had somebody internationally, an international figure pass away, that's kind of when I think our government really realized they had a problem. And that to me is disappointing, because as a government, as a parliament, your number one priority should be your citizens. And it was very disappointing that we, at that point, were not. In that event, though, there were also 10 Libyans who I have to mention passed away trying to save the ambassador. And so I do think that they don't get enough print space or airtime, and they definitely should, because their heroic actions have gone very much unnoticed. In terms of general challenges, aside from security, which I think is the biggest challenge right now, we have to understand that with democracy comes a need for transparency and accountability. And that is, I think, in many countries based by basic things like this, by free media. We do not have monitored or free or even educated media in Libya. It's basically anybody who can buy a television station can own one and can say whatever they want. And because Libya has such a low penetration of internet, only 5.5%, our reliance is on television and radio and word of mouth. Now, when you rely on things which do not have to be in any way accountable, it can create a lot of problems very quickly. You suddenly have rumors spreading like wildfire. These rumors then can cause violence. This violence then can cause instability, etc. And so I would have to say the biggest challenge for Libyans is corruption on all levels. But the most important one, I'd say, right now for this transition phase is media, is accountability, is transparency. Is the government, is our parliament having a spokesperson who comes out daily and says, this is what the parliament did today, even if it's Friday and all they did was sleep. Say, this is what we did, because that empty space is where the rumors start. It's where the confusion starts. It's where people start getting confused and making up stories. And so we need to definitely close that space. And we need to create an environment in which things must be true. In order for you to say something, in order for you to feel like you have to fight for an idea, ensure that that idea is actually sound. There's actually reason behind it. Me individually, our organization obviously focuses on the political, economic, and social empowerment of women, which is a very nice sentence, but very difficult to actually put into action. And our biggest challenges in that, honestly, is the general society supporting, I would say, that transition, because that's what it is. It's a strong transition for a country like Libya, is to have women in leadership positions. And so for us, media is obviously influential in our work, as is trainings, workshops, etc., which can then support women to first take the initiative. Because that's, I think, if tonight you're going to Mgedi, our president, our GNC president's speech, you'll note that he'll say people need to take the initiative. And I completely agree with him on that. We need people to be educated enough, though, to want to take that initiative. And so we have basic things, education, media, transparency. These things all need to be identified, I think, not only for Libya as a whole, but more specifically even for women's rights.
On the issue of women's rights and more generally in terms of going back to this idea of what's important to the Western world or the global north, however you want to call it, and what's important to the actual Libyans, I wanted to ask you whether this is an agenda of the Western world to push for this issue. My question is twofold. On the one hand, how much do you think that those concerns are justified, you know, our concerns in this part of the world about women's rights and women's issues, and how much that reflects reality and real concerns by people there. And I wanted also to ask you more generally about, you know, Western or external intervention in Libya. I know that, you know, in the whole of the Arab world, and particularly in Libya, there's a lot of tension as to Libyans being told what to do from the outside. How are those relations being managed?
I think the reason there is such a mistrust in the international community in countries which have recently undergone transition is because, as the gentleman said during the symposium, these countries are the same that openly and very graciously welcomed dictators only a few years ago. And so that shift to Libyans is difficult to understand. And I think it's expected that there is mistrust there in that relationship. And I think that the international community definitely has to prove itself to these governments, has to prove itself to these people. And I think that's extremely important because it's difficult for somebody to argue for democracy one year when only a few years ago they were openly supporting a dictator. That even me, I just don't understand. I can understand politics goes to a level, but they're, you know. When it comes to women's rights being a foreign idea, I dislike that idea. I don't think so. Because I don't think Westerners have women's rights down either. When I go to certain countries, I would not be allowed to wear my head cover. And in my opinion, that's not women's rights. It should be my right to choose, right? So it's very interesting the way we kind of try to say, well, obviously the Western world has women's rights figured out. I strongly disagree with that. And I think that obviously women's rights is going to be, or I don't want to say rights, but I want to say women's development is going to be very different in Libya. Our progress is going to be very different in Libya. Our end goal is probably extremely different. And the way our end goal looks is probably going to be even more different. But those are things that are, you know, indigenous to us. That's what we expect. Obviously, we are going to take, and our organization takes, a lot of things which have worked in other countries, be it the United States, be it South Africa, be it Rwanda, Kosovo, Egypt, etc., and other things that haven't worked in these countries, and utilize that to our advantage to see what we can and cannot do, what's realistic for us, what's not. But by the same token, we also have to understand that it will take a very, very different road, I think. And our progress may be slower, maybe quicker, but it will be our progress, and it has to be locally owned.
You know, you talk about the work that the international community has to do in order to regain the trust of Libyans. What sort of things do you think would help in that respect?
I think the foundation of trust would have to be unbiased support and unbiased encouragement. And that's going to be a test, I think, for the international community in the coming years, particularly with the international media playing such an important role. But the painting of the picture of extremism and terrorism and oppression, et cetera, that definitely needs to go away. I mean, we cannot keep looking at these countries, particularly Libya, and saying, well, there's extremism there, so maybe we should take a step back. It's going to be difficult for that to be a winning argument in Libya. There needs to be unbiased support, unbiased encouragement. It cannot be one day we agree with what you're doing and the next we don't. And also, I think there needs to be international coherence in the way that these transitions are being looked at by international governments and the community. And what I mean by that is, for example, you currently have a transition going on in Syria, which is not supported by a large group of the international community. And a lot of them are using the same excuses that were used in Libya, and to a higher degree, obviously, in Syria. And to me, it doesn't make sense. If the international community is so quick to push for democracy in one country, that should be something that they want to support in every country. And that should be an ideal that needs to be supported in their own country. There are banners and subways here that say, you know, in a war against the savage and the what's the other word? The educated one? Or a savage and the human, you always choose the side of the human or something. I mean, really? And when people wanted to white out that word savage because it was clearly an anti-Islamic, it was a pro-Israeli anti-Islamic board, they were arrested. And this is the United States of America, which is preaching to the world that, you know, we have freedom of speech. So, I mean, things have to be, there has to be some harmony in the message that's being sent across to these countries. There has to be some harmony in the message that's being given to people who are undergoing transition. Because if the person giving the message has no credibility, it's very difficult for us to say, yes, we trust this country.
Thank you so much for being here, and we're really honored to host you today.
Thank you.